Hello, everyone.
Welcome to the Tie Podcast.
Culture.
Competition.
Architecture.
The dirt.
Drinking.
Eating.
Reading.
Thinking.
God, I love the dirt.
Let's not waste any more time.
Let's go straight to the pod.
Thank you all for being here.
We greatly appreciate the support.
Welcome to the Tie Podcast.
I feel like I'm pretty good at recognizing how lucky I am to play golf. Like, I really enjoy, and even more so now that I'm working, like, it's... I really enjoy the opportunities that it's given me, and I wanted to share that with other people. Like, that makes me happy. And this is what I didn't know. When I stopped playing pro golf, I looked at golf architecture as a stable.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, oh, this is a real job.
Hello, friends of the Tie. My name is Walker Simas, and joining me today is Brad Gale. Brad has quite the journey through the collegiate, amateur, and professional golf world, though that is not the crux of the conversation today. After parting ways with professional golf a few years ago, he's begun a new profession under the same sport, golf course design. Funny enough, his first opportunity came at the Park in West Palm Beach under Gil Hance and Jim Wagner. There, he and 2019 U.S. Mid-Am champ Lucas Michel both spent many hours working. It might, to this day, be the best 1-2 combo of golfers ever seen getting their hands dirty on a construction site. We discuss what it's like being the pretty boy on site, knocking down the initial judgments and doing the work necessary to become useful. Over time, what it's like to learn and work with extremely talented shapers and architects from the ground up, not just at the Park, but all over. It's easy to see and understand Brad's work ethic through the things that he chooses to pursue. Statistically, the professional game and golf course design sport very few people comfortably. Despite this, he's made a decision and has already boxed out a spot to get his reps in with great coaches. Tough not to root for the guy. I hope you feel the same after listening, and if you do, please give him a shout. As always, thank you for listening to the Tie Podcast, and enjoy. Brad Gale is in the building. Thank you for being here. Excited to chat.
What's going on, Walker? Good to be here.
Not a whole lot. Yeah, I'm glad to be here too. You just got out of the water. We're both in Florida. It's nice to be on the same time zone.
Oh yeah.
Before we get into the bulk of things, I want to jump straight into the dirt. Brad Gale, what have you been drinking, eating, reading, and thinking recently?
Oh, I only had the thinking thing. I did a little homework on what I was going to say, but
drinking's easy.
I've got a Guinness because it was either that or a mimosa sour. So I went with a Guinness. So cheers.
Beauty. Cheers. I've got a Yingling in a bottle. We're both
rocking bottles. Good. It looks good. The Yingling. I wish I had one of those. Big fan of the Yingling. So drinking a Guinness. And I just got a coffee maker at the house because I left my normal setup on site somewhere. And so I had to do a whole new revamp of my coffee situation in the morning. And I'm still figuring out the intricacies of it. So almost got it dialed in, not quite there yet.
How do you take your coffee in the morning?
Just straight, just black. Yeah.
Like easy. A man.
Yeah. Right. Just none of that sugar. No, I love good coffee. And like a buddy of mine, Corey, is the one who like put me on to like, there's different, it's not just gas station or hotel coffee. Like it can be an enjoyable experience, not just like getting that caffeine in the morning. So,
is it straight out of bed or do you wait a little bit?
No, it's like it's got a setting on it so it can brew like when my alarm clock goes off. So I'm
amazing.
It's super high tech. So I'm like, I'm stoked on that. So I like wake up, smell the coffee, grab a cup, sit in my nook here, doodle a couple things, go do what I got to do. It's my routine right now. So yeah.
Eating.
Right, so that's eating. New empanada place in town, right down the street. It is awesome. It just was a pop-up. Like, I don't know what it was before, but that's been like I don't get to have... If I'm working, I'll like try and find like a Jersey Mike's or something like that, something easy and quick. But like Yeah, if I get a little afternoon where I'm like, oh, I could go sneak off a buffalo chicken empanada. That's been kind of this. It's right on Dixie here in West Palm. It's a good spot. So that's what I've been eating. What's the next thing? Thinking?
Reading.
Reading. I did just get the Mackenzie Reader. So oh, cool. They came out with that. Yeah. And it's great. It's really, and I haven't even gotten into the good stuff yet. So that's been my latest reading, you know. It's so poetic. It's like, you know, nobody's writing like that anymore. I feel
nobody.
Like.
It's I sad. Mean,
it really is a different time. I mean,
we were talking about Gray Carleton, and I feel fine talking about Gray. He's been on the pod, good friend of the Thai podcast. But when you get the chance to get a beer with him or hang out with him,
yeah, I can't wait.
Poke him about just the depressing architecture in the United States, and he will speak to you like they did in the old days.
Are you talking about like golf architecture? Or are you talking about structural architecture? All of it. Okay.
Well, I mean, talking
specifically
mainly buildings.
Oh, like buildings. Okay.
But the whole thing. I mean, yeah, you'll get into it. So
I love that. No, I mean, it's a whole. You know, yeah, things have lost, you know, a sense of taste is a little diluted these days, which is fine. You know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I'll be looking forward to that. That'll be pretty good.
What's on the dome?
Lately we had some weird weather here in Florida, which you experienced as well. It was like a mini hurricane. And so, you know, two nights ago, it was rattling around, super windy. You know, big swell, and then last night got ripping. I mean, just was not, and you could see a little eye starting to form off the southeast coast of Florida, and it's November. I mean, we have Thanksgiving, so I feel like hurricane season is past, you know, structurally speaking. And I had somebody that works in golf. I asked him, I said, you know, you've been in this industry for 25 years. I go, have you noticed anything with the climate? Like, is it shifted? You know, people talk about climate change and you know, it's hard to quantify that. It's hard to feel climate change, something that's slowly changing over time. But you know, scientists are, you know, it's kind of like a hot topic or whatever. And people have, you know, certain opinions on it, but I was, you know, people in the golf industry that are, you know, their job is to take care and grow grass and maintain turf, and Mother Nature is their biggest ally and obstructor and their everyday goal. You know, I wondered if you pulled a bunch of supers together and you talked about this, you know, what are you seeing? You know, are you seeing storms like we had in the last couple of days, you know, later in the year? Because that was what the guy in the industry said to me. He goes, yeah, he goes, it's not that it's just getting hotter all of a sudden. It's, you know, that's people's immediate perception of it. No, it's that summer shifting later in the year, fall's becoming shorter, spring's becoming nastier. That was kind of his like summarization of it. And yeah, so this storm, which is, you know, the week before Thanksgiving, is, I'm like, man, I thought we had hurricane season past us, but no, we had a pop-up one the last couple of days that really just, like, it was not on the news, nothing, and all of a sudden I'm looking out the window and we're getting like 50-60 mile an hour wind gusts. So that's what I've been thinking about. I know that's an interesting, you know, kind of off the cuff thing to think about, but that's what I've been thinking about. So
yeah, it's been gross, and it's been so nice out the last two or three weeks.
Oh my gosh!
I think it was amazing. The contrast.
That yes, you're right. I mean, we had bluebird days. It's been beautiful. I mean, you kind of have to, when you live in South Florida for more than like 2-3 years, you kind of have to start pinching yourself. I mean, it really is an amazing ecosystem to like be a golfer. There's quality golf down here. I mean, you can get it. I mean, in the summer, it's really hot. But I mean, it is an awesome place in the fall to be. And you can play golf every day. I mean, even in, you know, there's those pop-up storms that happen kind of in the summer and whatnot. But you can always find time for it.
So. Yeah. And to a certain degree, like professionally and all the rest, we have slightly different schedules and whatnot. But I always tell people, because, you know, my friends up north or whatever kind of hunker down during the winter, like as you do.
Yeah.
And I was like, I feel the exact opposite. Like I look forward to the winter. It's the best. Yeah. It's my favorite time. So
yeah. Well, I grew up in Indiana and I like the cold weather. I do. It gives you a break. It's nice to, you know, I do miss the seasons. I miss, you know, so that's what I'm looking forward to. I was like, I'm waiting for that 40 degree cold snap in Florida. And I'm like wondering, when are we going to get it? Because, you know, all those jackets that I brought down here for no reason at all are just collecting dust in the closet.
Yeah, and they take up half your closet, too. I know. It's the worst. It's
like, I need that beanie, but like I'm only going to use it twice.
I know.
But I know. I miss being up in Indiana and seeing the seasons. I was lucky to be in Chicago last October for the whole month, and it was just beautiful.
Yeah.
But when it comes to being able to golf, you got a short window.
Yeah. Well, we'll get into Chicago in a minute. We have a lot to talk about today. You are firmly rooted now in the golf course construction world and super excited to talk about that. I feel it is responsible to give the people some background on you. I'll start by saying this, and I really do feel this way. Because not everybody is like this. I know two things about you, not really knowing a whole lot. And that is, you've had a really wild path. Like, I have no idea how old you are, but you've had
32.
You've had a wild path so far. Yeah. And you have chosen, not fallen into, you've chosen to do some very difficult things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested as to why that is. I'll give some examples. So,
yeah.
And I'll let you run with any of these as you see fit. But you chose to walk on to the Oklahoma State golf team, which is incredibly hard to do. Pursue professional golf. I'm excited to talk about the Hangry Project. Your decision to invest in your community in a very mm-hmm. very real way. You've chosen to put in the creativity reps, which is, I think, hard to do. It's so easy to consume now. It's very hard to create, I think, and
it's well said.
Choosing to do that is awesome. And then obviously your decision to get rooted in golf course design, maintenance, construction, all the rest. So, do you mind giving the people a little bit of background on your story? And kind of what set you forward on this path, and then we'll pick it up somewhere in there and make our way to construction.
Yeah, that's a pretty good summary. I mean, you hit kind of all the points there. Yeah, you know, I was born and raised in Indiana. My mom was a golfer. She played golf at San Jose State, and my dad loves the game, and my brother plays. So it was kind of always in our family that, you know, we were golfing around the holidays and doing trips to golf too. Like we were going and seeing golf courses around Thanksgiving. You know, Palmetto Golf Club was a place that we were going to go to pretty much every Easter and Thanksgiving. So, you know, it was in my family, and then, you know, I remember I wanted to be like a professional in something when I was really young. And then, you know, that became golf and more clear kind of as I got older. And then in high school, you know, you said I chose to be a walk-on at Oklahoma State. It was really that I had the opportunity to, because it's, you know, that I wasn't a high-ranked junior. It was simply that they just had a slow year recruiting, and because the team was so good at the time. And, you know, it's amazing. Actually, this year, the other 09, Kevin Doherty, just got his PGA Tour card.
Yeah.
I mean, he is put in the reps, and I'm super proud of him. And it's a really, I mean, I think if you would have asked anybody, you know, are any of these two 09s going to make the PGA Tour? I think they might have laughed at you looking at us back then, because we were kind of just like, hey, you know, you could pick up the water bottles and hang out for a little bit. But, you know, it's amazing to see that, you know, Doherty's on the PGA Tour now, and I'm still so close to golf as I am. But that was a really amazing opportunity. You know, I've been thinking of reaching out to Coach McGraw lately. I haven't talked to him in a while, but
the reason I say that, Brad, is like, if I am correct, you were number two or three on your high school team. And
yeah, no, I was three.
I was thinking
my sophomore year. Yeah.
I was thinking about it, and I was like, how insane would somebody have to be to say, not only do I want to
that's a good
not only do I want to play college golf, but I want to play Division I college golf. And then I want to play for one of the best programs in the country.
Yeah.
And and it's not like it fell into your lap. Like you chased that really hard.
Well, I mean, that theme right there hasn't stopped. It's fun. You know, there's different points of this podcast where we'll probably get back into, like, there was a path that I could have taken and I went that path. But, you know, you only get one life. And I don't know why I've always been conscious of that, but I always want to get the most out of it and see what, you know, it all has to offer. And as far as, like, you know, that drive, you know, the two guys, Corey and Henry, that were the two guys above me on the golf team, like, they matured earlier than I did and they were good. I mean, Corey won state our sophomore year or something like that, or junior year. But, you know, I remember leaving Oklahoma State and wanting to be a pro golfer. When I called an agent, he's like, well, you're the sixth man on the team. You got no chance being a pro golfer. And so, you know, that theme has kind of been reoccurring for better or worse. I always want to, you know, I want to see what I'm capable of in a lot of ways. I'm really not that special. It's just, you know, my mom and my dad introduced me to the game at a young age, and I've been able to get to know golf, like, really intimately. And I just find it just the greatest game in the world. And it has a lot to offer, and it can teach you a lot, and it can humble you. And, you know, as far as the Oklahoma State thing and all the way into high school, I always wanted to be around guys that were better than me. I mean, I found that the biggest teacher and the biggest ally was that Corey and Henry were better than me, because then I could see up close what a state champ looks like and how he goes about his business every day.
Right.
And it's that saying, you know, iron sharpens iron. I still use that saying today at work, because I'm kind of in a little bit of a skill-based job, I guess you could say, right now. Like, I didn't really expect to be in that kind of position when I got into this industry, but I am, because my work, I've noticed, is a skill. It's not something that you just have. You have to practice it and get reps, and people call it hours, but, you know, it's, you know, I did my 10,000 hours with golf, and now I'm doing my 10,000 hours of shaping, and I'm just like, it's a funny, my clock just completely reset and went right back to zero. I guess I enjoy that, having something that looks off in the distance. Like, I like seeing that there's a 10,000 hour out there that I can go to. Yeah.
It's so hard because, unfortunately, when it comes to construction of any kind, but speaking in golf course construction here, it's like, doesn't really matter how cool of a guy you are. Like, when there's a task to be done, like,
I think it's worse if you're a cool guy. Honestly, I think it's a lot worse. It's not a good thing when people think you're cool on a job site. It's just not cool. I mean, like, you're the guy. I hate to say that people have thought of me as cool. I mean, I don't think of myself like that. I just like to think I'm a golfer that, you know, is doing golf course construction out. But yeah, it doesn't matter, because you're just trying to get a job done. You know, you're just trying to hit 2% grade in a fairway and get the water running 150 yards away from you into wherever it needs to go. It's like, don't care how you do it, just needs to go that way. And yeah, that's really well said. It's not,
and kind of continuing to hit on things very lightly, because we'll kind of dive deeper into each of these things. But you pursue professional golf in a very real way for quite a long time. Like, you moved down to Jupiter after school. Was it Jupiter or West Palm?
No, it was Jupiter. It was Jupiter.
And I'm not exactly sure how this occurred, but you, as I understand it, got in with a group of same thing, iron sharpens iron, like, very mm-hmm. elite players.
Yeah.
And and we're practicing and playing with that crew quite a bit. Mm-hmm. What was that experience like when you were
Well,
you know, going to bed every night, PGA Tour, PGA Tour, PGA Tour.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And it was like that for a long time. I mean, when I was at Oklahoma State, I was like, I'm going here so I could, you know, be on a great team and then develop myself into be a pro golfer. But my development didn't really happen there. I matured a little bit there, but not a lot. It was really when I moved to South Florida and I was living with Daniel Berger, and I was valeting cars, and he had just won both second stages of Q school. So I was like valeting cars and doing, I've told this story before, but like, yeah, I was picking the range balls and valeting cars at the dive preserve. And then they let me play in practice there while I was doing that. And Daniel had just won both the second stages. So he had like status in Europe, status in the US. Like he was locked in. He was extremely talented. So like, yeah, I'd always, you know, wanted to see how good I could be against these guys. And it was really in that time where, you know, I had to really focus on my time management because I had to work and then I had to get better. And I'd missed pre-Q like that first year. And like, that stunk. I mean, you don't get nothing for missing pre-Q, but yeah, I started getting into the money games at the dive preserve after work and just like having to go to the gym, you know, put in my shift at work so then I could go play after work. Like, you know, there was no, you know, front and back end. There really wasn't much going on. It was just like, I was so focused on my time management in that amount of time after college. And, you know, that's when I really, and, you know, not wanting to lose to Daniel, cause like he's really good and he talks great trash and like, he's just, you know, he's that guy that's just, he's so talented and he shoots low scores consistently. I mean, at least this is, you know, when we were playing then, it was just like, it felt like he was shooting 66, 65 every single time. And so, yeah, I wanted to see, you know, just clipping him off like one time, which I don't even know if I did. Like, I can't remember beating him. Like, I really can't. And that's really when I kind of got better at golf and really came into my own as kind of like the player that I was trying to become. And yeah, my sole focus was playing on the PGA Tour, and I was surrounded by a lot of really talented players. But it's a bit of a double-edged sword in Jupiter. And this is something that you can try and explain to kids that are coming, that want to move here, and they see the Jupe life and they see all that stuff. But like, you know, I'm not as talented as Daniel. Like, I'm not, you know, I don't move it as far as he does. I don't really have like that level of confidence that he had. And just the way he was able to go about, you know, just, you know, kicking the crap out of me every day. And so doing the things, if I were to, you know, I could mimic some, I could always take little things from Daniel and learn from him, just using him as an example. But you can't do everything that they do. You know, you can't be on their practice schedule. You have to find what works best for you. And that's one of the toughest things about, I think, Jupiter is, yes, it is an amazing place to have your iron sharpens iron mantra, but also, you know, you have to find out, like, you know, for me, it was what Brad Gale does best. And there was a lot of searching in that. And that's kind of where surfing came into play and paddleboarding and all of these other hobbies that I know a lot of pro golfers don't have. And that was probably one of the first indicators to me of like, okay, you know, for me, it was like a relaxation thing and like just getting away from the game and doing something that I love as a kid, just getting in the water or whatever. But at the end of the day, was that really making me a better golfer? I don't know. And so, you know, that's an honest conversation that I can have with myself now, but I think I was pushing that down the road at the time. I don't regret any of it, but it definitely makes me think when I see kids that are coming up now and the way they go about their business. I mean, those ones that don't have hobbies and that live at the golf course, I think I have a lot more faith in them than the ones that are going surfing after the round. And I know that's a broad spectrum statement because maybe that kid going surfing is more talented and you just don't know what he's capable of. But those are the things that I kind of think about reflecting back on that time.
That's really interesting. And we all have like these maturity periods and often multiple of them, you know?
Oh yeah.
Like, many, many multiple. I mean, both of us have like seasons and seasons ahead, God willing. And yeah. And it's cool when you've lived a long enough life to to kind of look back at some of those.
Oh, it's a weird thing to say, but yeah, you're right. Cause I still feel young, but yeah, you're right.
Right. Like, man, yeah. I just didn't see it.
Yeah.
So from there, I want to talk about, can help guide me to the Hangry project. So how do you get from being deathly focused on honing your golf game to carving out enough time to figure out some of these other passions?
Well, I always just had this bug in me that I wanted to like have like a foundation or like give back, because I feel like I'm pretty good at recognizing how lucky I am to play golf. Like, I really enjoy, and even more so now that I'm working, like I really enjoy the opportunities that it's given me. And I wanted to share that with other people. Like, that makes me happy. It just really, seeing other people experience something that I've been able to experience and it brings them joy, mm-hmm. makes me happy. Like, that is a really important thing in my life to continue to recognize. And so I think it was just somewhere in, I was just not playing well in, you know, not having a good stretch, and I was on the Latin tour, and I was just like, you know what, I'm a smart enough kid and I can find the time to just start this, and it can be really small. And it was really just the simple idea of filling up the fridge at Phipps Skate Park down in West Palm. And it was nice, and it was small, and we made, you know, the logo was cool, and maybe that was a nice indicator of creativity, was that the logo, I wore it to a Christmas party and people were like, that's cool, what is that? I was like, I made that, and this is what it means. And in that short little 30-second interaction with people, like, I saw something in them that clicked, and I was like, okay, this is something. So it just, you know, when you see that click in people and it brings joy to the conversation, and it's not just a boring conversation, you're not just talking about the weather, now you're talking about, you know, where is Phipps Skate Park, how many kids skate there, you know, who are you, you know, what are you putting in the fridge, now it's a broader conversation. And, you know, people always love the line that I got a lot was like, I used to go to the skate park and then I stopped. Well, why did you stop? So that conversation goes from like a surface level, just, you know, how are you, you know, nice shirt, to now we're talking about, you know, a nostalgic past of skateboarding, or, you know, I actually have a foundation where I do this and this, that's really cool, and maybe we could do something together. It's just always, I enjoyed having a level deeper of conversation with people when I was talking about the Hangry project, and I loved going to the skate park and having the act of filling up the fridge and seeing the kids that, you know, we're interacting with it and using it. So yeah, you know, as far as finding the time stuff to do it, again, it was one of those things where it's like, is this giving me joy? Yes. Like, is it making me a better golfer? I don't know. Maybe my bad days aren't as bad right now, because I know I've got that little bit of joy to hang on to if I go shoot 80. So, you know, and I won't be so self-loathing if I play bad. I'll think about the Hangry project, or maybe, you know, do some stuff with that. So, you know, was it, you know, smart to do it that early? Probably not. Do I regret it? No, it's one of the best things I ever did. And it's always, you know, I enjoy trying to find out more about myself. And that was really one of those keystone moments where I was like, yeah, this is what Brad Gale likes to do. Brad, I like the fact that the Hangry project is this thing that has gotten attention from other people that I would never thought it would get attention from. And then COVID obviously allowed for a whole nother opportunity, getting into the whole summer school thing.
Well, I commend you for it. I've gotten some advice recently that I think, for whatever reason, I think it's easy to feel this way when you're in your early 20s, but I think by default you become very me, because you just like don't have a lot and you're trying to figure out what you're good at and you feel like you suck at everything and XYZ. And usually, at least the advice that I've been given and what seems to be true now, is usually just like golf, doing the opposite thing is usually right.
Yeah.
In other words, in this case, giving.
Yeah.
And I just think it's super cool that you actually followed through on that, because I think it's pretty easy to to see an opportunity and maybe to make a small change, but to go in there and get your hands dirty for a year plus,
yeah,
and sit with these kids and truly make a lasting difference is like that's real talk. Like that's good stuff.
Well, I appreciate that. I know that, you know, it's, I don't know. There's a line in the summer school film that we did that says like the ripple effect is real. And it's like, I do, I believe in that. I believe if you throw a little spark out there, it might catch fire. You know, it might not be today, but it could be somewhere else. And I believe that in a lot of different aspects of life. But with the Hangry Project, that's been the little spark that I've been able to kind of watch grow and, you know, learn a lot about. Again, it goes back to time management. You know, now I'm working and that's a whole thing that I have to, you know, I have a very challenging career ahead, and you know, allocating the time to Hangry and hitting all the important things that need to be done, not just, you know, in the act of it, but there's a whole financial side that needs to get taken care of as well. And right. You know, I'm the captain of the ship that needs to keep it all running, but that's just a part of growing up and a part of, you know, if you're going to light that fire, you better keep it running. So
yeah,
it's good stuff. I really do enjoy it.
So in some ways, I'm sure that the Hangry Project and the documentary Summer School was the beginning to a lot of kind of creative interest and reps. Like we talked about reps earlier with design, golf course design and construction.
And now a quick word about our friends at Good Walk Coffee. Mr. Simus, what's your coffee game been like recently?
Man, I always, and I mean always, have the Mudball Half Calf on me. I've been loving the Bump and Run cold brews on the go. And lately, it's been the breakfast ball.
Give me a little bit more color on the Bump and Run cold brew.
Well, I love making coffee at home, but I can't do it all the time. And when I really got to move and I need my Good Walk, I reach straight in the fridge, grab a can, and go, and I get exactly what I need.
Where can the people go if they want to get involved with our friends at Good Walk Coffee?
You can purchase all your coffee, cold brew, espresso, pods, cases, beans, merch, and more for 20% off using code THETIE, that is THETIE, at checkout. Set your custom subscription. The world is yours only at goodwalkcoffee.com. So, with reps in mind, you mentioned that, I guess, offline, your brother does some short films, lives in Chicago, has kind of a skating background.
Yep.
He was kind of a played a main role in that. And then you also mentioned a Tom Sachs and kind of his involvement with the project. Can you help me understand, like, who came together and helped you put some of this stuff together? Like, when you do hard stuff, you gotta have mentors, you gotta have teachers. How did that work?
I mean, a lot of it's my own, you know, being naive and just thinking this is a good idea, you know, and like, okay, let's, if I think it's a good idea, how long do I want to think about that idea? And like, do I want to make that idea come to real life? Because I, you know, a lot of people get good ideas and they just kind of brush them off to the side. But like, there's some ideas that you think are worth pursuing. And Summer School was definitely one of them, where it was like a time and place late into 2020 where it was like, okay, you know, we've got this group of kids that don't really know what they're up to. I was watching a lot of Wes Anderson films at the time, and just, you know, and I was meeting people, you know, as I said, David Hamzik, who is my right-hand man for Summer School. And like, my brother's always been an inspiration, like I wanted to do the film with him, which, but that just like wasn't logistically possible. But Summer School was one of, and I can kind try and guide people through it, but basically we had the Hangry Project. So we had this group of kids that were actively using the fridge, and just watching them and hearing them talk, they're hilarious and they're really funny. And like,
kids rock.
And there was some local organizations that I felt could be doing more to introduce people that just otherwise wouldn't go to the golf course. And that was my biggest thing. Like, you're always going to have a certain group of kids that are just going to go to the golf course. That's awesome. Big fan of that. But there's the group that wouldn't go there otherwise and like need a little bit of help. And that was the group that I was kind of focused on. So, you know, here's this group of kids. They'd never been to a golf course. Golf was kind of something that was outside, and we could kind of corral it in a safe way. And we started filming it. I didn't really have any guidance as far as, you know, like the producing and directing outside of David. And yeah, I started just going into this idea. I actually didn't even know the name Summer School until late. I think it was in the winter. But then the Tom Sachs thing came about because I was talking about it in the same way I'm talking about it with you, with my sports psychologist at the time, Greg Carton, and he was a friend of Tom's. I was like, no way. And sure enough, there was an opening in New York for Tom's work like later that week. And so I basically just flew up to New York and I met Tom then and talked about the Hangry Project, talked about golf, and just was, he's one of those, I mean, he's such a smart guy and he's just a complete genius when it comes to his art and his craft. And then, yeah, he was kind of a mentor, but not really. I mean, it wasn't like I was, hey, what do you think I should do with this? He was just more of an inspiration.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, Virgil, you know, was around at that time, and Virgil's another one of my biggest, I was never able to meet him. But that's like another one of my biggest inspirations for all this creative stuff. But so, yeah, anyway, we go through the process of making Summer School. We put an end date on it for the premiere, which was June 10th in 2021. And yeah, we had the premiere for it. All the families came. It was just like the most special moment ever. It was a culmination of a lot of hard work. And I know people that build golf courses can probably feel the same way in certain moments, but basically that was our, you know, our opening day. That was our premiere. And it just tied a bow on this amazing chapter that was hard for a lot of people. COVID was not a good time for a lot of different people. And, you know, I just, in a lot of the bad, I wanted to do a little good. And that was really what it kind of all boiled down to. And then the creativity and just finding creative solutions for all the problems that come with trying to make a short film. I thought that was great. I really, really enjoyed that. It was a lot of fun.
Cool. So moving on slightly, I do kind of brief segue before we get into some of the projects that you've been at kind of the last couple years. You know, one of the parts that I love about, kind of a common theme of what you've been doing the last couple of years is, well, more than a couple, is that like when you do things, you have this imposter syndrome of like, oh, I'm shouldn't be here, not good enough to be here, I have so much to learn, all of these things, right?
Oh yeah. Yep.
And it creates this environment, like I'm really big on environment, and it creates this environment for these like really sobering moments. Mm-hmm. Usually they're like pretty shitty in the moment.
Yeah.
Like really shitty.
Yeah.
And then after the fact, they get sweeter and sweeter and sweeter because they kind of inflict this change in our lives.
Yeah.
And I'm confident that you know what this feeling is like just because of what you've been through.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious kind of where you got the most of that, whether it was chasing professional golf, whether that was in the middle when you were kind of like figuring out this creative push, this desire to kind of help out this community, and then this interest in design, right?
Yeah.
So it's like clearly when you're working on a golf course construction project, I'm excited to talk about the trenches, kind of the early years. That's a great environment to get that sobering feeling. But I'm curious if you felt it prior to that.
Yeah, as far as the imposter syndrome of like, yeah, starting to feel the creative pull away from professional golf, it wasn't really then. That imposter syndrome, you know, I understand myself as a golfer pretty thoroughly. And like, it was really on a subconscious level. I never was, you know, when you're that battle to like, I never didn't want to go practice. I didn't want to go through the reps. It was just, you know, I found myself doing other things maybe when I should have been doing like going through not just practice, but like a more specific practice. Mm-hmm. And not just, you know, existing or like, you know, looking for a game when really I don't need to go play. I need to actually go work on something. So like little things like that, I was still out there doing stuff, but maybe it wasn't the right stuff. But I, you know, it's so cool. Cause I always, one of the biggest things that I always said was to myself, at least, was that I didn't want to keep playing pro golf to the point where I hated it.
Yeah.
And hate is a very, you know, it's a slippery slope and it's a tricky thing and it can grow. And I was able to recognize, you know, just the timing of it all. I was able to say, this is my last golf, professional golf tournament. And I was actually in Indiana and my mom was able to come watch me play. My mom and I are very close in the sense that she's always been with me and supportive throughout my entire professional career, because in a way she was living her, which she never had, career through me. And because she turned pro, taught a little bit, and then had me and my brother. So she didn't really, but, and she plays mid-am stuff, or she used to, but never really gave it a real run. And I always felt like I could kind of carry that for her in a lot of ways. So to be able to say, to be able to like understand that I was done with professional golf and I was ready for a new chapter, identifying that as golf architecture and design, and being able to, you know, say this is my last event in my hometown at a great golf course. It was at Campin in Lafayette, in Indiana. And, you know, I missed the cut, but I shot under par in the last nine holes, you know, like little things like that. Just all felt right. All felt good.
Yeah.
And then I knew the park had began construction, just because of locally with having the Hangrew project, people were kind of, hey, this is going on. It's a community driven project. Maybe you should find out more about it, and maybe we'd love to, you know, involve you in some way. And so in a lot of ways, I think people were looking like, hey, you could get the Hangrew kids out there when it opens or something. But I kind of had a different idea, and that was, and people, and this is what I didn't know. When I stopped playing pro golf, I looked at golf architecture as a stable.
Yeah.
Like I was like, oh, this is a real job. You know, this is going to be stable and I can have a career and I can make, you know, I can make a living out of this. This is great. And then as I've begun it, I'm like, oh my God, I don't know what was more stable now. It's like, this is a whirlwind of a beginning to what I hope to be a career.
And that's a beautiful, we could do an entire podcast on this one subject. And
I had no idea. I had no clue.
So let's dive deeper into that. Right. So, before we get into kind of where you are now exactly, let's start with the very, very beginning. So you start at the park at West Palm.
Yeah.
How did you get that job? It's incredibly difficult to go work for Gil. Like you can't just,
well,
I know that you rocked up and said, hey, I'd love a job and got one, but like,
yeah,
you know, at this point, 10 years ago, it wasn't this way. But now there are a lot of young people who want to do this work, and it's not just like apply and they're like super, super thankful to have you. It's, they're obviously thankful to have help out there, but like,
yeah,
there is some demand for this work for young people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, how I got started was pretty absurd. I mean, I showed up and I was like, I just quit pro golf. I need a job, you know, and it wasn't that I didn't say I need a job. And I said, I need to start. I said, I just need to start. If you could get me off the starting, I just, you know, I live here, you know, I'll do whatever. You don't have to pay me. You know, I just want to start. I want to see what it's like. And Jim Wagner was, you know, kind enough to, you know, interview me, or, you know, just talk about some golf holes that I told him was backwards, which was hilarious. Cause again, being super naive, we were talking about a course that I had played where he was getting inspiration from. And I was like, isn't this backwards? It's like the dumbest thing I could have said. But, you know, I wanted to start, and they did, and they gave, and, you know, and Gil's, was like, hey, a lot of people want to start, but not a lot of people want to hold a rake in their hands for 7 hours. I was like, I'll do anything. You know, again, this is just me being naive and having a clear vision of where I wanted to go and understanding that the steps that it was going to take to get there might not be pretty. And that's okay. And I was willing to get my butt kicked after, you know, there's this, in a way, I was like, I wanted to go be by myself in a field and think about all the mistakes I had made playing pro golf. I wanted to be alone with a shovel in my hand, just, you know, thinking like, man, if I would have done, you know, to have that time to myself and out there in the field, it was kind of like romantic in a sense. I'm like, hey, you know, I need something humbling right now. I need something like this. And if it's hard work and manual labor, that's okay. I can get through that. And so I started at the park, and, you know, I was working with the cavemen, out there, and Josh McFadden was the lead, and, you know, it was just, it was awesome. I mean, I was doing it. I mean, I was like watching them build holes on the fly and watching the creative process. And like, they were kind of nice enough to like, I got to listen to some of the conversations that they were having. And you've been on site, so you understand when there's the architect out there and the young guys, it's like, you don't really always get those really, you know, all of a sudden things can just pop up. Like, how did we get to that? Like, why is that bunker there? But knowing why it's there was something that I really kind of got to feel at the park, which was really cool. 'Cause that was kind of one of Wagner's big things, was like, I don't care really what you do. You know, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. I've made every mistake that you're going to make. It's just have a why behind it. And then we can go from there. You know, don't just do something to do something. Just at least have a purpose in all of your stuff. And I wasn't building anything out there, and I was really just kind of a fly on the wall. And yeah, that was my first introduction to it. And I just, you know, I loved those little moments of the creativity that you got, whether it was like some planting stuff that we were doing or the revet line on a bunker, where you got to sit back and really make an impactful decision to yourself. It wasn't for the whole of the project. It's not going to be impactful, but as you know, it's like, you know, I could do this and it's going to take me maybe 2 or 3 days to do that, but it will turn out. I think that will turn out cool.
Well, it is interesting too, because it's like, whether it's the lip of a bunker or plantings in a native area or a piece of drainage, somebody's going to have to do it. And if it's going to be done right, some human is going to have to do it right.
It's all intentional. It's all, so it's
even the menial stuff is so important. Like, people talk about a golf course being there for 200 years. It's like, you really want a golf course to be there for 200 years? You've got to nail it every bit.
Percentage of golfer do you think, I'm asking you this question, what percentage of golfer do you think recognizes that?
Almost none. And I can shoot that question right back to you. Like, you were of the, I know, of the fraction of a 1% in terms of ability on the planet, right? And and that is true. And I would find it incredibly hard to believe that you didn't walk away even from 2 weeks on site with like way more understanding of what went into that whole deal than you did ever playing professional golf.
Well, I think I'm a better golfer, which is weird. I don't practice as much anymore. And like, obviously, like, you know, people say your short game takes a hit first and like a little bit, but like the way I think my way around a golf course is like, I'm not the longest hitter, but I'm long enough. And it's like, now, a lot of times, you know, my thing is always push, like I try and push it up there a little further and maybe, you know, clip off a little more of that edge. Now I'm like, just like hit it over here. Like, I make it easier because I see, you're right, everything that's done on a golf course was done by human hands, unless you're in the rare exceptions of like a links course or, you know, but most of the American golf courses, you know, weren't windblown sand like St. Andrews. We know that. But so it was an intentional motion to either replicate something of that, or it's out there. It's just, this is the golf course. It's right in front of you. You hear that saying a lot. And now I just find myself just kind of playing chess. And it's like, I'm a pretty good wedge player. So let's be a good wedge player. I want to try and like make a wedge from 90 yards. It's super fun for me. So, you know, I know that I've got a threshold of like 245 where I'm like, can land it soft enough to stop on a normal green. And so anything I used to just be like 255, 265, I would still try to push up and just pitch it onto the green, but pitching isn't as much of a strength as my wedging. So I'd rather just, I find myself looking at like, where's the 90, where's 100, where's 120. I find myself when I play golf looking for that number more than I am looking where is, how far it is to the green. So that's one part of it in the strategy sense. And then the second part would be the aerial aspect of the game. A lot of, you know, I always find it kind of funny when you're talking about a lot of the landforms and the movements when I'm probably just going to hit it over it, you know, and it's sad, I think, for a lot of architects to hear that, and a lot of real, you know, I don't even want to know what you would call that. There's a group that, you know, romanticizes the golden age that you know, a modern player is just going to hit it over it. Yep. We're probably just going to, and it's not, but it's not about length. It's more so about the fact that we can just, you know, I know that if there's a pot bunker in front of the green at 80 yards, my wedge is going to go 90 yards. And that pot bunker, as scary as it looks, I have faith in my ability to hit it 90 yards. So you can make it as scary as you want, but if that player is conscious of their and trusting of their 90 yard wedge shot, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So then how do you, I think, and I didn't get to know Pete Dye enough on an architectural level at all, but I'm sure people talk about the way he messed with your depth perception of certain bunkers that weren't really in play, but might've had more of a, like a counter to your line and just made you think a little bit more. And that little think, I know architects have talked about this before. That's what they're most of the time trying to get a player to do, is to think,
yeah,
for better or worse for that player. So no, I find myself thinking about and reflecting on these things as, you know, I still think my golf game is evolving, but as I'm learning golf design and the construction of it, but as I'm learning the golf design and why certain things are placed where they are, that those are the things that I find myself kind of reflecting on a lot.
Cool. So moving on from, well, let's just say your first couple weeks on site.
Mm-hmm.
When you started to work with the grounds crew at the park, mm-hmm. you're transitioning out of that phase of like, man, I'm, because from everything I've experienced and from what I know about yours at the park, it's straight manual labor. Like when you're during construction, yeah. Like there is nothing else.
Yeah.
And it's great. You get some walk arounds with the crew, you get some camaraderie over time, you build friendships with people.
Yeah.
La da 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 da. But eventually, you know, Jim Craig says to you, like, hey, if you really want to know this stuff, you've got to work on the maintenance crew. And it's even though it is still manual labor, it is a very different world. So talk to me about the differences between the construction and the agronomy side.
Well, you know, there are different roles out there and it's different jobs.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, for me, it was, I didn't understand, you know, that those guys with Gil and Jim and the Caveman, those guys are pros. I mean, those guys are studs. I mean, they're
crazy how good they are.
It's crazy. It's nuts. Some of the best in the world. And so when I joined them, I thought I was joining them, but it really wasn't that. I was just having the opportunity to kind of hang out for a little bit. And, you know, and Wagner was like, hey, if you really want to do this, you need to work on the grounds crew. And so I went with Frank O'Rourke and the grounds crew, and, you know, his sense of urgency and his attention to detail every day, there were things that needed to get done. They need to get done now. And it wasn't later. And it was just, you know, the pace never changed. In construction, it's fast. And then in the growing, it's faster. And, you know, people think about watching grass grow. Well, there is a, you know, 100 different things that you can do on a day on the maintenance crew that are all important. But that, I think the biggest thing, and you could probably attest to this, is the moves get smaller. You go from big landforms in construction to this lake or cut fill, and then all of a sudden, you know, you go all the way down to leveling heads, and then you're trimming heads, or you're blowing off the leaf. So it's like, I felt like the detail just got smaller and smaller, and all of a sudden we're watching an Instagram reel of someone with scissors cutting off the rim of the cup. It's like, okay, that's a little much. But like, you know, that was my thing, is that the progression of attention to detail went from broad strokes to very specific, hey, we got an early tee time, go, you know, knock the dew off some of the tees for him. That was kind of, I think, to sum it up in broad sense. And you know, it was tough. I mean, it was very humbling, I'll say that, you know, coming from pro golf to then having to do just the monotonous task of mowing fairways. I remember listening, and I told you that I don't really listen to podcasts that much. I'm a big music guy, but I remember I was listening to like an audiobook on like the French Revolution at one point, mowing a fairway. And I was so deep in that, I was like, oh my gosh. And I actually haven't talked about this much on kind of outside of my friend group, but one of the best things that it did allow me to do was continue the creative process that we were talking about. And I ended up writing a script called A Monday in Palm Beach. And I went to the same restaurant every day, every Monday of 2022 that I was in town, because the work at the park had become, you know, it wasn't so tough, but it just was not what I was used to. I knew I could get myself a nice dinner on Monday, and I'd get a martini, and I would just write all of the different things that I loved about Palm Beach, and I packed it into a script. And so it was kind of a time and place. It was, you know, it's last year, and I ended up finishing it. But that Monday for me changed a lot and really continued to just for me to learn more about my creative process, because there is not a lot of creativity in maintenance. I don't believe. I mean, there's creative solutions to problems, obviously, and different things that arise each day. But a lot of times you're just kind of knocking off those tasks. And it's very much that, there's that Jiro Dreams of Sushi. You ever watch that movie?
No, but
it sounds like
I need to.
Yeah, no, it's a good one. It's a good one. But basically it's this master sushi chef. And he's like, he's done the same motions, the same prepping for decades. I mean, just 20, 30, 40. I don't even know. I mean, it's all in the movie, but it's that same motion every day of how you prep the rice. It's that same motion of how you cut the tuna. And over time, I mean, there's a son in his movie, and that's one of the greatest things. There's like a conflict kind of between Jiro and his son. His son's been doing it for 30 years or 20 years, but his Jiro's been doing it for like 40. And it's like, that was to me what golf maintenance was. It was like, you're doing the same motions to get the incredible same product every time.
Right.
But there's not a lot of creativity, but there's a lot of honor in the repetitive excellence that is expected of you.
And maybe nobody else can notice it. They just see the final product. But day after day, week after week, you as a person start to notice those incremental differences.
Like, there's a word for it. I'm missing the word right now. But
it's small things. Like even when I'm driving a tractor around, it's like, you know, like I shift gears easier. Like I just drive it better over, you know, if I small things like that.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. There was things that happen in construction that will lead to, like, you know, you can't build something that can't be maintained. That's like one of the basic laws of golf construction. It's like, so yes, I did learn. I remember I went to one of the first jobs that I went to after doing maintenance is, you know, I went to Ireland. I actually did a small film project in Ireland after working on the grounds crew.
Curious about that. Share whatever you're allowed to share there.
Yeah, I can't share much about it, but basically it was like a time and place for a family documenting their trip to Ireland, which might later on that footage might resurface. But what it did was it allowed David and I, the guy who did summer school, we traveled to Ireland for an entire month and basically was just out of a van. And I got to play all these amazing golf courses and film it too. And so it was really an inspiring opportunity. It was a nice, okay, I'm done with golf maintenance. I've learned not a lot, but a little bit. And now we can kind of get back to focusing on the things that I got into this for. So it was a really nice time stamp. Just be like, boom, okay, that's done. That chapter's passed. Now let's go continue on the path. But I remember the next thing that I saw was in golf construction. I saw a guy, it was during a grow-in. He was filling up his mower on the green with the gas. And I just remember, I was like,
what?
I know. And it's like, I just remember looking at it. I was like, can't do that. But, you know, as a like rewind 3 years, I wouldn't have known that. I just wouldn't be like, he's filling up his mower. It's cool. You know, he's fine, but like, you can't do that. Can't
fucking new guy.
Yeah, right. So I just remember I was looking, I was like, can't do that. And then that was the moment. If you want to talk about imposter syndrome and all that stuff, that was a moment for me where I was like, I'm so glad that Jim told me to work on the grounds crew.
Yeah.
Because I was able to look at that, kind of laugh at it, keep walking.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do that. So, yeah. Yeah.
That was me, just a short time ago, and it'll be me again, just another another situation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, awesome. Whether it's filling up gas on the green or something else, it's always going to be, you know, somewhere to learn from.
That's great. I mean, everybody says that. I've heard it enough to believe it, that it's like, what do they say? At the end of your life, you're standing on top of a pile of all the mistakes you made.
Oh, you know? Geez. I hope not.
Well, I mean, hopefully I can see a whole lot from up there.
Oh, it's a pretty big pile. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So after Ireland, you move on to, was it Sedge Valley next?
Yeah. I was able to have the opportunity to walk around with Tom Doak at Sedge Valley. And he was like, you know what? We're getting pretty busy. We could use some help. And I didn't know what I was doing or who I was going to do it with at that time. And, you know, and it's funny because you kind of alluded to this earlier. It's not like how it was. I mean, Tom's story is amazing. He's like, he wrote Pete like multiple times before getting back to him. And it's different now. And especially right now, because things are happening in golf course construction. I mean, there's a lot that's going on across the plate. And
like, if you just look at Florida, the amount of new builds that are happening right now.
Well, Florida's this is nuts. I mean, I don't even know how, I really don't know what to make of it. I really don't, because, you know, I've got guys telling me, smart guys, that are like, this course is going to be the best course. And I'm like,
no.
I was like, hey, you know, and I try and guide the conversation in not an educational sense without seeming like I know that much, but I know a little bit. And it's like, it can only be so good in Florida. I mean, it's a limited template, if you want to call it that, for lack of a better word, or canvas. Let's use canvas. And so you've got a limited canvas with Florida sometimes, and the topography is flat for the most part, but you've got sand. So, you know, who's to say which is going to be the best out of all of these? How do you, you know, there is a massive bunch of combination of things that have to go right for something to be considered the best. And we are, you know, you and I are in this world where we like talking about the best, and like, there is the best out there, which is so cool. And that's one of my favorite things about all of this is, you know, when I was playing professional golf, I played a lot of okay golf courses. I mean, not a lot of great, honestly, not a lot of great ones. I definitely didn't like, I didn't know, you know, that there were other fine wines out there that were really, really good. And this year I made it a point to seek out some of those and get a little taste of what good looked like. And Ireland obviously was that. And Ireland blew me away. I mean, I've got pictures and images in my mind of shots and things that are just the feelings that you can't describe of shots that you're hitting that were just, I felt like I was meant to be there hitting those shots at that time.
Yeah.
And then coming back here and then seeing some of the American design that was influenced by that 100 years ago and the conversations that they must have been having then. And then also, how did they build that? What did they use? It wasn't a bulldozer, because they just invented those a little bit later on, you know? So how many horses, you know, how many people? Yeah. What was the, you know, that's what, to bring this up, I, you know, Seth Rayner is you know, it's funny. I call him a favorite architect of mine, and a lot of people immediately put you in a box of like, oh, the guy likes Rayner. He likes, you know, geometric shapes or something like that. It's like, okay, bud, you know, that's cool. But, you know, how did he build that so perfectly? You know, how did he, what was his mythology into being able to, you know, because the amount of work he did was a lot, but the amount of variety he had was a lot with only those, you know, however many templates. To me, those are the things now that I'm really, I don't know, paying attention to, trying to learn more about, get to know more. I think that's the coolest thing about this new golf boom, because you don't see a lot of guys. I don't know. It's just, I can't wait to have this conversation 20, 30 years from now. I mean, really, because this is, I think anybody, you'd be naive to say this isn't a special moment of time in building golf courses, for sure.
It certainly is. One more thing about kind of architecture, and I'll segue this into my next question. Is, you know, you were talking about Rayner, and I think about Ross too. Just the, you know, I grew up in North Carolina, so Pinehurst was obviously a huge influence. And, you know, and then when you start talking about Ross, particularly in the Northeast, what really blew me away was the greens up in the Northeast, how they would basically find all the rock on the property and then just kind of like stack the rock, you know, in piles. And that's what they would build greens on top of. And the first time I started doing some of that reading and then, you know, judging by like the golf courses you play, because this is like a multifaceted thing. Like you're playing the golf courses, and then you're reading about them, and then you're building things that are not exactly that. In fact, like far from it, but you're kind of like trying to put all this stuff together.
Trying's a key and, word.
Trying is the key word. That's for sure. And, but that kind of, that always blew me away. And I agree that like the, well, I guess what I'm trying to get to here is the history, right? Like I'm so glad that Gil has taken on this, you know, it's not just Gil, but particularly with his restoration work, he's made it a point to very publicly, state that like a lot of these restorations are not purely to the credit of Hans Design Company. Like the, they are very forward with the historical images that they have and the inspiration that they take for these restorations. And I think that's really important for, you know, this ebbs and flows. Like we will not be making a whole lot of golf courses at some time. And then when you and I are old or gone, we'll build more again. And, what the next generation will have that we didn't necessarily have is loads and loads and loads of documents as to, you know, how we're creating what we're creating. So I'll lead that into Brian Schneider, right? So you did some work with kind of alongside Brian at Skokie in Chicago. And Brian is super well read and all this stuff. He loves the history. And Skokie has a lot of history. So tell me about that project. Tell me about Brian. What was that like?
I mean, it was awesome. Because it was an opportunity that I feel very fortunate that, you know, the guys at Renaissance Golf Design have allowed me to work alongside them in some of those projects, and Skokie being one of them. Skokie kind of being the real first, because Sedge was kind of, it was a lot of the things were done and it was kind of just a lot of tie-up stuff. But Skokie was like, actually, that was where I kind of really, as far as shaping is concerned, it was the first time I really got thrown in the fire, as you know, because you've got a contractor that's in the bunker behind you. You're in the bunker shaping now, and they're coming to you next. And then, you know, it's a schedule, and it's October, and you have to finish before winter. And in any day, that storm can come through where everything turns to mud. Yep. And then it's going to be a mess. And then you're going to be fighting all the way into the holidays. And so I was very new to the shaping aspect of things. And you know, the thing about Brian is he is very well read, but and he's a good mentor in the sense that like he loves it and he's been there and he's been thrown in the fire before, and he's not one to forget that. And he is always so relatable in his journey, even though it's so different from mine. It's just like I'm always able to have I don't have to sugarcoat anything when I'm talking with Brian. It's like it's a work thing. It's like, you know, he understands that my skill set is not as good as his skill set, going back to the skill of shaping. But how are we going to get to that common goal where, you know, it's not really, because we're not in situations like that. We were replicating a lot of the Ross stuff in that era. And it was very specific. We had aerials that were pulled and we could really see the lines. As long as there wasn't a shadow coming over from a tree, it's like we had, you know, two files from old aerials. And I remember, you know, to talk about mistakes, there was one area where this bunker tailed away way to the left. And I mean, into no man's land. And it wasn't prepped and it wasn't ready. And I had gotten the, you know, I had kind of hugged the green on the first part. And then all of a sudden I'm looking at this old aerial and it's like going way over here. And it's like in the way of, it just wasn't, nothing about it made sense. And I compromised. I kind of went in the middle of the shadow, but not like, I just kind of was like, okay, I'll just like put it over here, tie it in, call it a day, go to the next one. Brian came like 3 days later and it was like, nope, not. He's like, and again, he wasn't frustrated. He just was like, we're not compromising here. We're doing exactly what Ross did. We're going to put it. And it was just like, he's like, I already told you that once. I don't need to tell it to you again. And that's the thing is, he was just sticking to the plan, being specific in what he told the club he would do. And my untrained eye was trying to reason something, just looking at it in the ground. And that was not the place to do it. And so, but the way I never felt like I made a mistake, I felt like I just learned a lesson, if that kind of makes sense. And the way Brian can articulate that, and we talk about this new crop of young guys coming out, I find guys like Brian such an amazing, I'm glad I meet people like him in the industry, and not only to meet them, but to be able to learn lessons like that and work alongside them is even more so a cool thing. Yeah. And then, yeah, that was a really fun project. And then like towards the end of it, there was like one bunker that it was like in a shadow and it was just like two hot dogs was drawn on the ground. I was like, we're not gonna have two hot dogs. So I was able to do something cool. And I know Don Cross at Skokie and Eric up there know exactly which bunker I'm talking about. But that was like the one that I got to put a little more of like something into it because of the way the shadows were on the aerials. And I got to go back and see it this summer and ride around with Don, the superintendent there, is just one of my favorite people I've ever come across in this, in the golf course industry. And I just, yeah, it makes me happy talking about it. So it's cool.
That's really good.
Yeah.
Brad, we're getting a little long here, which is my bad, but, no, okay. let's close this out with a, final question of the day.
Okay.
Tony, is it a Ruggiero?
Yeah, the dew sweeper. Yeah,
the dew sweeper, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I listened to your pod with him. I really enjoyed it, and I love his content. He teaches a lot of great players, and I know you two work together.
Mm-hmm.
He described your outlook on golf as special, and I love that because, especially as you know, as a high level player, you have these conversations with coaches, you know, and they. Mm-hmm. High-level coaches only want to work with high-level players. They want to work with players who believe in themselves and really are out to do something.
Yeah.
And but I could tell that he saw something different in you. Like you had a different appreciation of the game than people who were just golf competition hardos, right?
Okay. Yeah.
And I would certainly agree with that, but you've expanded your horizons in the game like greatly over the last 4 or 5 years. I think that pod was in 2019. And I'm curious how you would define your outlook on the game now, just given the breadth of work. Like you've seen so much in golf. How has that changed perhaps since you were a player only?
I actually find myself leaning into the fact that I am a player more so these days, in the sense that A lot of the original guys to build golf courses were players. A lot of the OGs. Now, Rayner wasn't, which is cool. I like trying to figure out his background and whether it was geodesy and the civil engineering that people talk about. But, you know, there's a lot of new people in the game of golf right now. And what it's been able to do for me is make me, and I have an amazing group of friends that are in golf, some that own brands, some that are photographers, some that are professionals. I've got, you know, you could call it both sides of the spectrum if you want to say mm-hmm. that. Tony's another one. He's a coach. You know, you've got a lot of people can make a lot of money off golf. And, you know, I tried doing that professionally, putting food on the table for my family. You know, that's something that wasn't going to happen professionally for me. And that's really what I'm, you know, out to do now is have a career in golf. And it's something that I talked to about Smiley Kaufman the other day. I was able to play Panther National with him and Justin and see that course, which is super cool. But I was like, hey man, it's so cool that you have found something in golf that's not playing professionally, but still fills you up and you get to talk about it and you get to, you know, now he's doing a podcast and he's announcing and it's just, I find it cool. And I find myself, you know, I just got my amateur status back and I can't wait to write a score down. And so all of that encompassing is basically just, you know, one of the things that I had an agent tell me was like, point the thumb, not the finger. And I think in golf right now, it's getting so big. A lot of us can just point the thumb and be like, what do I believe in? Because when it comes to like yourself, when it comes to everybody else that's out there, I don't really, you know, everyone's got a lot of opinions and about a lot of different things, where the game's going, you know, what it was. It's not as good, you know, there's all these different opinions, but just tell me kind of what you believe in now. You know, what are you looking forward to most when you go play golf? Because I think a lot of, you know, at the end of the day, I think that's really a lot of us want to do is be able to keep playing the game we love and learn the lessons that it kicks back at you. Being able to work in the industry is something that's even more of a cherry on top for me. Mm-hmm. Having a, you know, the whole thing with golf architecture and design is I get to keep practicing the creative process and learning, because there's so much more. There is such a pile of knowledge that comes to golf architecture and design that I don't know about, and construction and maintenance, that I've never really shined a light on until these last, you know, 3 years or so. And every time I scratch a layer deeper, I just want to go even further. But to me, that's my thing right now. I mean, that's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life, is continue to kind of go a little deeper down that route as a golfer. And I want everybody else that's in this space to do the same when it comes to golf for them. And in that, I'm going to be able to, you know, have that, goes back to that layer deeper conversation. And we're not just going to talk about the weather and that it was blowing 70 in Jupiter the other day. We get to go a little further than why, you know. Those are the things that interest me in the game. Those are the things that, you know, bring a lot of us together from all sorts of walks of life all over the place. So it's cool to have a guy like Tony say things like that, and other people perceive my beliefs about golf in a high way. That means a lot to me.
Yeah, you tied that in like a Seinfeld episode. That was pure class.
No, you teed me up for it. No pun intended. Oh gosh, my girlfriend's gonna hate that.
Love it.
That's good. That's awesome.
Brad Gill, thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it and enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, man. That was good stuff. Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.